And it is 11:07 on WGN Radio. Steve Dale here for, do they call this late night? Late at night?
Nightside.
Nightside. I knew it was something like that. But that sounds like someone's at your bedside that's going to put you to sleep. We're not going to do that, actually, at all. We're going to learn a whole lot. We're going to have a lot of fun as well. Coming up, I mean, you see the cranes all over Chicago. So the good news is there's tons of construction going on. But what's going on? What buildings are being built? We're going to learn about that. Also, the Chicago Architecture Foundation has a new center that will open soon. We'll hear about that as well. And also the cruise that goes out. I love this. And you don't have to be a tourist to do this. That's the thing. So it seems as though it's big for tourists, and that's wonderful. That's appropriate. But how about all of you who haven't seen, you know what, I go on it every single year. I really do. And I learn every single year. Also, later in the show, something very much to look forward to, and that is the Chicago Margarita Festival. We'll also talk about the Cat Convention. But first, Dr. David Rubin is in the studio. You know, if I read your title, I have never seen a CV so long in my life, Dr. Rubin. Had I printed that out, it would have been, what, 104 pages or something like that? I mean, literally, it would have been that long, right? Have you printed it out at all?
No.
You have no idea how long. But I hit the print thing because I didn't scroll down. And then it shows you how many pages. And it would be like 104. I mean, you travel all over. I'll give the official title. Joseph B. Kirzner, Professor of Medicine, Section of Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition, because one just isn't good enough for you, Co-Director of the Digestive Diseases Center at the University of Chicago. So in English, what does that all mean?
I specialize in diseases of the intestines and nutrition related to those diseases.
And like Crohn's disease? What would some of these diseases
be? Yeah,
well,
so my actual specialty and what I spend most of my time doing are studying these immune conditions called inflammatory bowel diseases, Crohn's disease, and ulcerative colitis, which are on the rise all over the world now.
Why?
Well, we're not sure, but other things are on the rise that are similar. Rheumatoid arthritis, asthma, allergies that we hadn't heard of when you and I were young, like peanut allergies, right? Lots of changes that have occurred all over the world.
So how are these things?
We don't know why yet.
So how is Crohn's disease, say, connected with peanut allergies?
Well, they're different immune reactions, but the similar observation is that, number one, they're both rising all over the world in different parts of the world. And number two, we think that they're triggered by something in the environment. So obviously peanuts, when you're exposed to peanuts, it can induce some type of immune reaction. If you're allergic to it, it can be deadly. But Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis are both chronic conditions. Usually young people get them, but now we know older people can get them. Where the normal immune system of your intestines, which is really quite amazing, is out of control and continues to think that something is going on or to react to something we don't know about, and it can cause damage and a lot of symptoms. What we've learned, though, is that these might be a result of what's changed in our environment. Think about all the things that have changed in the world we live in. And we're learning much more about that through some of the exciting research going on now. And thankfully, there's many more treatments for these conditions.
Okay, so I want to talk about some of this a little bit. So I'm going to take one of them, Crohn's disease. What is that exactly, first of all?
Mm-hmm. Crohn's disease was actually named after a doctor named Burl Crohn, and it came after a paper that was published in 1932.
So if you make a big discovery, it'll be Rubin's disease?
Well, no.
You hope not?
Because actually, this might even be a little trivial, so we'll get past that. But back then, they used to alphabetize the authors of scientific papers. And now, when we write scientific papers, the first author is presumably somebody who did the most work, and the last author is the senior person, and all the middle people are contributors in different ways. But the three authors of the paper that led to be what we call Crohn's disease were Crohn, Ginsberg, and Oppenheimer. Alphabetical. And the guy who was senior said, nah, I don't need to be on it. His name was Berg. So he would have called it something else.
It would have been called Berg's disease or something like that.
But besides all that, so they recognized this condition, which was characterized by uncontrolled inflammation of the intestines. And when you have inflammation in any part of your body that's not under control, it can cause damage. And the damage that occurs can lead to scar tissue, which can cause problems like obstructions or
pain. Is that like being... It's late at night. We could talk about these things. Is that like being constipated?
Yeah, but this is much more painful and much more difficult because when you have severe obstructions of the bowel, you can have life-threatening conditions.
So there was a video. Lord knows why this video was sent to me, Dr. Rubin, but it was of an elephant, an African elephant on the plains of Africa. And the elephant couldn't defecate, and what was back there wasn't coming out. It was kind of stuck, and the elephant died because it presumably went weeks like that. And you could see tears coming from the eyes. The elephant was in pain,
I'm sure.
Clearly. Of course, with a person, there would be someone. I mean, you can't walk up to an elephant and easily treat the elephant, although people could, I suppose. But in the wilds of Africa, that's not so easy. So is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
It can happen where people have progression of the scar tissue, then the bowel doesn't move properly, and it's extremely painful. Any organ in your body that's hollow and has a normal function of squeezing and moving things, like the intestines or the tubes that connect the kidneys to the bladder or the uterus, any of those organs, when they're moving something that doesn't go through, causes severe pain. And that's what a bowel obstruction can be. And people who have chronic damage to their intestines from a condition like Crohn's, where the immune system is ongoing, end up having problems. And it's fascinating because the immune system of our gut is designed to protect us because other than your skin, your intestines see the outside world more than any other part of your body.
Whoa. What do you mean by that?
Because everything you eat samples the environment.
Yeah.
And your body has to continuously determine whether what you're eating is going to hurt you or whether it's going to help you, and whether it's nutrition you should absorb or bacteria and other organisms that you need to be protected from. So in a condition like Crohn's, one of the theories about what's going on is that the immune system that's normally there to help you gets turned on, and either something's there that's still triggering it, and we haven't quite figured that out yet, so it's driving ongoing inflammation, or you're missing the off switch. So it gets flipped on, and then your body can't regulate it. So a normal condition after you eat dinner, as many of the listeners tonight, I presume, have done, is that your intestines become a little bit inflamed. That's a normal condition. And then it calms down after it's done what it needs to do with what you just put in your body. And this interaction between the environment, food, and our immune system goes on all the time. It explains a lot of things, not just a condition where it's abnormal like Crohn's disease, but we're now learning it explains many other conditions. And that's why we, in my field, think that the intestines are really the center of the universe. We can learn a lot about other things that way.
Well, in fact, I did a race, if you call the way I run a race. I was telling you before the show, I ran a 5K, and it was for ALS. And I recently read somewhere that what is in our gut and the way in which, exactly what you said, the way in which our individual guts operate can really be responsible for autoimmune illnesses like that, ALS and MS, multiple sclerosis maybe, and some other illnesses. Is that true?
Well, there are a number of theories and some evidence to back that up. And one of the thoughts is that if you're exposed to certain proteins in the environment, or what we call antigens. Antigens are things that stimulate your immune system. They might result in a cascade effect where other conditions get turned on or turned off and can cause problems. We're starting to learn much more about what's called the gut microbiome. The microbiome is the term we use for all the organisms that live in and on our body.
How many organisms live inside?
Well, in the gut, the majority of them live in your large intestine.
And how many are there?
And there's over a trillion bacteria. That's just the bacteria. That's almost as much as the U.S. debt. And there are many more viruses and fungi and a variety of other proteins and other things that live there. It's an incredible ecosystem. And the old theory about the bacteria and other organisms in our colon was that it was just sewage, that it wasn't important, that it didn't do anything. And what we've learned now is that our intestines evolved, like the rest of us, to live in harmony with the environment. And in fact, we're hardwired to live with a lot of that.
But the environment has changed a lot.
So one of the major theories about what we observe in the human condition now, all over the world, is that as the environment has become cleaner, or we've cleaned it up, or we've eradicated parasites, these types of organisms that used to live in our bodies. We have essentially deprived our guts of what it needs for balance. And that's a major theme of a lot of what we're learning about the intestines.
Now, that's so I happen to know that's huge right now in medicine. I happen to know it because you've told me. And I've read about it as
it's
well.
It's a reliable source.
Yeah, I think so. But I want to back up and explain that again because it's complicated about what you mean about parasites inside us. So explain what you mean.
Well, for example, there are many parts of the world where it's still common that you might have certain types of worms or other organisms that actually live in your large intestine in harmony with other organisms there, and they stimulate a type of immune response, but it's the immune response your body's built to handle. And so that immune response gets turned on, it turns itself off when things are under control. If you get food poisoning, for example, that's your body's immune system protecting you. So the reason people who get food poisoning, because they eat something that's got bacteria in it, is the intestine starts to expel all the toxins. It makes you vomit, it makes you have diarrhea. And the reason for that is your body's trying to get rid of what's going to kill you. And sometimes it could if you wouldn't have access to the right treatments. So the idea of the immune system of the gut being always something that we want to turn off and never let it do its job is wrong. The idea that everything that lives in our intestines shouldn't be there is also completely wrong. And now we're starting to learn that what's going on in our intestines and how they interact, all these organisms interact with each other, gives us insight into obesity, can give us insight into sleep disorders, may explain some of the psychological problems that we observe in our society, anxiety, depression. There may even be a link to autism. There's a lot of really unbelievable and very interesting conditions, aside from what I specialize in, Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis.
All right, so I was just at a veterinary conference. And at this conference, because for those who don't know, for 21 years, can you believe it? 21 years, I've been doing a show about pets here. And I'm a certified animal behavior consultant. And like you, but not nearly as often as you, I speak around the world, in my case, about animal behavior. And there's a new product that is going to come out on the market from Purina. And it's a probiotic. A probiotic for dogs, specifically geared to deal with anxiety, which is kind of what you just talked about here.
Sure.
And apparently there's research that's Purina. So there's a human arm of Purina, Nestle, and they're working on a similar sort of product, or I believe they have one, for people.
Well, I have no conflict of interest in saying this. Nestle is doing some great work in this area, and they're invested heavily, as have other companies, in understanding the gut microbiome and how it might yield previously unknown clues about all these diseases, but very importantly, obviously, how we might treat them differently. And the concept of probiotics is something that's one of the most common questions we get asked in my field. And a probiotic, just so the audience knows, you see the term all the time.
Excuse me. I don't want to miss this.
Yeah.
So is it possible to create a probiotic, and we'll explain what that is in a moment, to deal with anxiety in people?
We don't know that quite yet. We would like to think that therapeutic probiotics or therapeutic, what we call in our field, manipulation of the microbiome or microbiota manipulation.
Ooh, fancy.
It's a medical term.
Yes, I'm sure.
Could in
fact, we paid good money for that too.
Induce changes in people's behaviors, certainly help them with other diseases and other conditions. But we're still in the very early phases of this. So as enthusiastic as we are about anything that's called pro something, let alone a probiotic, the truth is that we're still learning a lot about this. There's still a lot more that needs to be done. And it would be premature to say that we can use probiotics to treat anxiety. But we've learned a lot more about how these organisms interact and what we might do in the future to modify the microbiome in positive ways. And I can tell you and the audience a little bit about some of that. Can I back up and tell you what a probiotic is, or at least
yes,
what it claims
that
to be?
That would be my next question. Well, claims to be. Interesting.
Well, in general, the concept of a probiotic means it's a bacteria that is good for you in some form. It may, in fact, be a yeast as well. Sometimes that's lumped in that category. And the general principle is that there are some organisms in our gut that are, in general, favorable. They don't induce a lot of inflammation. They might even be anti-inflammatory. And there are other organisms that are bad that can cause problems, or when they grow too much in our intestines, they can cause a lot of disease or other symptoms. So the general principle of probiotics is we give you lots of the good bacteria, and we hope that we're going to overcome whatever's abnormal or imbalanced and push you into the area where things will be under better control. The reason I say about claiming is that the evidence supporting probiotics for many of the things that they are proposed to help with is not very strong. And that's in part because probiotics aren't regulated like other therapies, where we need strong evidence and scientific studies to guide its approval and availability and
so when
over the
you,
counter.
So when you walk into the store and you see a selection of 20 probiotics, which one do you choose? We will find that out. Also, our phone number, 312-981-7200. You can call, you can text. And we do have a question about what happens when you travel and your stomach doesn't appreciate the beautiful location you happen to be at.
Yeah.
Dr. David Rubin is here. He'll answer those questions and more. Dr. David Rubin is here, the guy with a long, long title at the University of Chicago, a professor as well. And we are talking about gastroenterology, and we're talking about probiotics. So you go into the store and you see really 40 choices. How do you know what, if anything, is right for you?
Well, it depends what you're looking for, first of all, which is complicated. But one of the things your listeners should all know is that there have been studies that show that more than half the probiotics on the shelf are not even alive anymore.
Whoa.
You're putting dead organisms into your body that are not doing what they're proposed to be doing. So you need to find out which of the organisms that you're going to be consuming, and if you're doing it for a condition that you've discussed and have a thought about what you're trying to treat, are actually quality and still alive, because that's how they're supposed to work, is these organisms need to be alive.
How do you know? Do you open up the bottle, shout in there and say, hello? And if they answer, they're alive?
It's a challenge. First of all, even the ones that are refrigerated or that are listed as live culture, you have to know whether or not they've been kept at a certain quality so that they stayed that way. You can read about some of the probiotics that are manufactured by some of the companies that do so in a good way. And you got to be cautious about those that say there are multiple organisms all mixed together and this is going to be the greatest thing since sliced bread, because that's often not the case at all.
And if you go online, is the information right or not necessarily?
So some of it is. I certainly, without promoting products, and I don't have any tie to these, but I would say that Procter & Gamble makes some. You want to look for some of the brand names that make products that are either quality products, and you know the company that's making them is taking care to make sure that what you're putting in your body, first and foremost, is actually what you think it is.
Made in the USA, does that matter?
It might, but not always.
Okay. More questions for Dr. David Rubin. Lots more questions. 312-981-7200. This is WGN. Dr. David Rubin is in the studio, gastroenterologist with the University of Chicago. I don't know how to introduce you because you are modest about being world-renowned. I mean, you are. How many countries have you lectured in just this year alone?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't counted.
It's like 5, 6, 7, 8.
But you know, I identify myself as a doctor. I spend half my time with patients, and that's where my identity is, and that's what informs everything else I do.
Is that what you love most still?
Yes.
With all the things that you do?
I'm asked this often, and I think about it often. If I stripped away all the other things, it would still be about taking care of people, and that's what I love. And everything else I do is supposed to inform that, and that's what my mentor taught me, and I certainly live by that.
I met your mentor once. He was a young guy at the time. I think he was 102 or something.
Yeah. Well, you introduced me
either.
As the Kirzner professor.
I have no
idea. And Joe Kirzner worked at the University of Chicago for over 70 years. He lived until he was 102, as you said, but he saw patients until he was 95.
Amazing.
Yeah. So for those who are thinking of retiring early, imagine his career.
You're not kidding. And the influence he had and the influence you have. Answering questions like this at 312-981-7200. So traveling overseas, things sometimes happen to your stomach. So this listener wants to know why and what to do about it.
Well, we were talking about the gut microbiome, all the organisms living in your bowel. And people should know that within 24 hours of being in a different locale, and that certainly can be overseas, but you know what else? It could be going to Los Angeles from Chicago.
Really?
your gut microbiome shifts. And it's related to not just, everyone talks about don't drink the water when you're in certain places. No, it's the food, it's everything in the environment. And our gut is constantly reacting to the environment. For most people, it's pretty stable and it'll bounce right back. But for people who get constipated when they're traveling, or people who get traveler's diarrhea when they go to certain parts of the world like Mexico or other places, that's just related to you're not used to the normal flora that your gut should be living with, and that just changes the way things are balanced. And a great example are people...
It doesn't have anything to do with drinking too much tequila in Mexico. I'm glad to hear that.
It does not.
Okay.
And it's not always the water. It's the food you need to be careful with, too.
Just because it's different, not necessarily because it's bad.
Right. That's correct. So, of course, you can also get something bad, but normally it's related to just being different.
So what do we do about it when we travel? We know, so for some people, it's predictable. You know it's going to happen. I think some tummies are a bit more sensitive than others. So what do you do?
Well, if you're going to certain parts of the world where traveler's diarrhea is endemic, where it's common that you get this, there are precautions you can take beyond just watching what you eat or drink. There's some antibiotics that are proposed that actually have been documented very nicely to prevent traveler's diarrhea, and they're gut specific. That means they don't leave your intestines, so they don't cause other problems. And there are other things that people have done, like trying to use probiotics in that case, which might actually help them. And in fact, the military uses this so that the troops don't get sick when they go to certain parts of the world. In our patients who have chronic intestinal disorders, when they're going on vacation or on a honeymoon somewhere nice, we talk about whether they should do this so that they're going to enjoy their trip and they won't get sick. And so you can definitely talk to your doctor about ways to prevent that. The other thing to know about is that as soon as you move back or get home or come back to from where you're from, everything shifts back to normal very fast.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a fascinating thing. Parts of the world where the inflammatory bowel conditions, we talked about Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, are very uncommon, like India, for example, although it's rising there. If people moved here from India years ago, their kids would develop Crohn's and colitis like the rest of the U.S. population. So that was not so surprising. But the environment has changed so much that we now see that people who move here from India themselves develop these conditions within 10 years, because that's how fast the environment has been changing, and that's how fast their guts have been changing. And some of them tell us when they go home to visit family from where they came that they get better really quickly. So this is a shifting, constantly changing organism that lives within us in our intestines and how we think of the microbiome.
So an impala eats about three things. You know, it grazes on that kind of grass and that kind of grass and that kind of grass. Most animals don't have, even our relatives, chimpanzees, gorillas, bonobos, and orangutans, they have a variety in diet, but not the extent that we have. For people that love food, do we put our stomachs through torture?
Well, we certainly are eating food that our bodies did not evolve to handle. And that's one of the reasons why there have been some very popular descriptions of eating more plant-based foods and trying to avoid some of the processed foods. And in fact, there's some compelling research that suggests that emulsifiers, which are some of the components that are in our foods that are either preservatives or additives to our foods, are actually breaking down the normal intestinal lining of mucus that leads to our intestine and our immune system getting exposed more to those organisms.
What are emulsifiers?
Well, there's certain emulsifiers that are in almost everything. When you start looking for them, you might be surprised that they are in lots of our foods as preservatives and as additives that help our food stay fresh when we are eating it. So there's all this suggestion that the things we've done to our food to make it more palatable and the diets that we've adopted in what we call the westernized diet, which is high in fat, more red meat, are things that might be driving a lot of our different problems. So it certainly makes sense, even if the evidence hasn't caught up yet, to be eating more vegetarian type style diets or Mediterranean style diets, which is fish, olive oil, some of the nuts. In fact, on the segment before us tonight, they were talking about that, and that's a good thing.
So for people that do that, are they less likely to have digestive problems?
Well, we haven't seen that evidence yet. And likewise, for people who already have some digestive problems, we don't know yet if diet is sufficient to get them under control. And so we want to emphasize to people who have digestive illness or digestive symptoms that there's a difference between modifying your diet and putting yourself at risk for becoming malnourished. And some people go to the extreme with some of this, and they actually do more harm than good. So it's very important to understand how to stay nourished while you modify your diet. Diet is what you take in. Your nutrition and your nourishment is what your body needs. And the distinction is important.
Does it bother you when people read about here some diet, or they're listening to a radio show and hear about a diet, and then go ahead and do it because it sounds so good without consulting their physician?
Well, first of all, I completely understand why they do that. Everything you eat makes you feel a certain way, and there's something to be said for you are what you eat. And when you have GI symptoms especially, you think that it must be what I'm eating. Why wouldn't it be because I feel this way? Sometimes you're right, and sometimes you're wrong. It's just that your intestine is sick, but everything you put into it makes you feel worse. So they really do need to be careful about just eliminating things or assuming, for example, the latest fad or one of the latest fads, gluten-free diet, mm-hmm. which was discussed a little bit earlier. Gluten-free diet, people are trying it for everything. Well, if you eliminate gluten, which is wheat protein, from your diet, it actually does reduce some symptoms like bloating. Some people feel better on a gluten-free diet. It's really only needed for the condition called celiac disease, where you actually have an immune response to gluten.
Mm-hmm.
But when you take gluten out of your diet, aside from the fact that it can be expensive and difficult to maintain, you might feel better for a little while, but there is no evidence that that actually reduces inflammation if you don't have celiac disease. So there's lots of things. And I think people naturally look this up and read about different options. And I would say to anyone that if you're going to try a new diet, make sure you're thinking carefully about your nutrition. Make sure you're not missing or covering up something that you don't know you already have, and talk to a doctor. But also, don't do anything to extremes. Everything should be in moderation. It's the old story about everything we do in life.
Now, the most important question I can ask you. You've got a decision to make. And forever, I don't even know. I should have looked this up, but I thought, okay, I'm curious as to what you think about this. Forever, for generations, people have been saying when a decision is about to be made and you don't know what to do, go with your gut.
Right.
What does that mean?
Well, on the surface, what they're telling you is to not think about it too much.
Don't overthink it. Yes.
Go with your instinct.
Why are they using it? It could be, they could have said go with your instinct, but they didn't. They said go with your gut.
Two things. The first one is that you know that your brain and your intestines are related. People who get nervous before they do a radio show they're going to perform in a professional or amateur sports event or speak in front of the public or take an exam, you know, you get butterflies in your stomach, you could get diarrhea, you could throw up. There's this very tight relationship between what's going on in your head and what happens in your gut. And so that's been well known forever. But I'll tell you something else. The gut has a nervous system that is as complex as your central nervous system in your brain. And in fact, there's as much serotonin circulating around in your intestines as there is in your brain, which is why we sometimes use, for people who have oversensitive bowels or other problems with their intestines, we sometimes use some of the serotonin reuptake inhibitors like Prozac and Zoloft and those drugs to treat gut problems. And in fact, I tell my students and some of the fellows when I'm teaching that I think that the next explosion in our field, which will be great research and new therapies, is going to be related to the enteric nervous system, which is what it's called. So there is something there that might be more than just go with your gut because it sounds good, but actually that your gut has its own brain and you should listen to it sometimes.
You heard it here first. You're amazing. Do I get my continuing education credit for this?
I will definitely give you some education credit.
I
hope I can come
this.
Back.
Of course you can, when I'm on. Dr. David Rubin, University of Chicago, how do people reach you?
Well, they can reach me certainly at the University of Chicago. They can also follow me on Twitter. So my Twitter handle is IBDMD, Inflammatory Bowel Disease MD, IBDMD, and I'd be happy to have them follow along, and they can learn a lot more of this good stuff that way.
Yeah, your Twitter account is amazing. Dr. Rubin, as are you. Thank you so much.
I appreciate it.
All right, we're going to learn about the Chicago Architecture Foundation and what they're up to after midnight. The Chicago Dogs, the baseball team. Have you heard of that baseball team?
I have not.
We're going to hear about them next on WGN. WGN Radio. My name is Steve Dale. It is 11:50. You know, I've wondered about this baseball team called the Chicago Dogs. And it interests me because here it is, a baseball team that's all about not cats. It's okay. It's about dogs. But I don't quite know if I exactly have that right. Tim McBride, Chief Marketing and Entertainment Officer for the Chicago Dogs baseball team. How are you?
Hey, Steve, I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much for doing this. Who are the Chicago Dogs? And do you have to blow a whistle before the start of the game so they all pay attention? How does that work? Are they really dogs on the baseball field?
You know, not those kind of dogs.
Darn it.
We had a lot of fun with the with the name here, and definitely pay homage to the Depression named sandwich, the Chicago Dogs, that has become so famous in these parts. But definitely, definitely welcome animal dogs as well, which I know we're going to get to discussing here in just a minute.
We will. So it's really about the Chicago hot dog. So here's the most important question of all. Where you play baseball, which is a beautiful place. I think you just won an award, actually, for the place where you actually play the games. Is there mustard served on the hot dogs?
There is mustard, and I'll let you in on a little secret. We do have ketchup. You might get hazed a little bit for actually using the ketchup dispenser, but it is available, and it's something that we have a lot of fun with.
All right, so I alluded to where you play baseball. It is a beautiful place. Where do the Chicago mm-hmm. Dogs play their home games?
Sure, we're located in Rosemont, just by O'Hare, and our stadium's called Impact Field. It truly is a world-class facility. I'd like to say it offers all the quality of a major league ballpark. It's just a smaller version of one, but certainly, Mayor Stevens set out to have a vision of bringing top-notch baseball and a great venue to Rosemont, and we're fortunate enough to have the opportunity to call it home for the Chicago Dogs and put our team on the field and welcome the fans to Rosemont and put a great entertainment product out. It's something that is affordable and accessible for really anyone and offers all the modern ballpark amenities, and is just a great experience.
Is this a minor league baseball team?
It is. It's a minor league team. We are actually an independent team, which means we're not affiliated with a major league franchise, but we are in the American Association. So some of the bigger teams in our league are the St. Paul Saints, certainly one of the best minor league organizations in the country. And then there's teams in Kansas City, Lincoln, Nebraska. Next season, there will be a team joining our league from the Milwaukee area, so that'll be a nice nice rivalry to add to the league.
Is this AAA?
It's a AA level. Our league, there's two major independent leagues in the country. One is the Atlantic League, so mostly on the East Coast. Oddly enough, there are a couple teams in Texas in that league. And then there's the American Association. The Atlantic League features a little bit of a older player that may have already spent some time in the majors and are looking to kind of get back with a major league franchise. Ours features predominantly more of the up-and-coming players that may have missed out on an opportunity somewhere along the way and are still looking to get in. We do have, several players that have played in the major leagues. Actually, Rafael Palmeiro plays. Yeah. For the Cleburne team that just came through town last week, and it was neat to see him playing with his son on the league. So we do have those major league connections, but generally our players are more kind of on the way up and trying to fulfill their dream of making it to the big leagues and extending their baseball careers for as long as they can, which is fun to do for them.
Sure. Now, listen, I love the Chicago Cubs. I live right near Wrigley Field. I'm a lifelong Cub fan, and I may be the only Chicagoan who will also say, and I do mean this, I'm a White Sox fan as well, and love going. And in fact, I did a run, a 5K run, and it ended in where the Chicago White Sox play. What's it called now? Guaranteed Rate Field. So it ended
Guaranteed Rate Field
And I wasn't guaranteed to finish, but it ended right there. And it was cool running through the field. So I love going to our two baseball teams in Chicago, but it's not inexpensive to do. And for an entire family to go to a ball game for a couple of beers, some of those hot dogs, and whatever other food you eat, never mind the parking. Oh my gosh, what they charge for parking now, and the ticket cost itself. I mean, my goodness, that's a week's salary. I mean, really, it's not inexpensive to do. And one of the appeals, I think, of what you do is you provide entertainment, decent baseball for sure, and it is affordable. How affordable is it?
Oh, yeah, it's a great, like you mentioned, it's a great level of baseball. And it's something that is, I think, as you touched on, it's repeatable for most families and most sports fans, so you can definitely come out to more than one game a year. But touching on the affordability aspect, most of our tickets range in the $9, which is our bleacher seats, up to $16, which are the infield box seats in our main seating areas. And we do have a couple of premium experiences. We have home plate box seats, which are, you know, the best rows right behind home plate. Those go for $25. And then we have an all-inclusive club level experience that is equally affordable. It includes beer, wine, and soft drink, along with a premium buffet with your ticket, and that's $100, which is our most expensive ticket. But that's, you know, that's quite the experience in terms of enjoying the luxury lounge and, you know, the premium buffet. So, yeah, you know, to have that all packaged into one is a great deal if that's where you're looking to go. But yeah, for the common fan coming, most people are paying $9 to $16 for the ticket. And then, you know, parking, as you mentioned, that's going to set fans back $3. So right, you park in the stadium garage connected to a beautiful Impact Field. You pull right up and you pay $3 and, you know, you're steps away from the stadium when you exit your car.
So you're talking to the guy, the only guy in Major League Baseball history that threw out a ceremonial first pitch with two dogs, the kind with four legs, at my side, because I created the whole idea of bringing dogs to a ballpark, and the Chicago White Sox years ago thanked me with that honor to do. Now, you're a different kind of dogs. Having said that, you are inviting the dogs very soon, some adoptable dogs from the Anti-Cruelty Society.
We thank you for beginning that great tradition here in Chicago, and we're certainly following the lead of what a lot of major league teams and minor league teams have copied around the country, because it's just a great night. People enjoy bringing their pets to the ballpark, and we have teamed up with Anti-Cruelty Society to also make it a night where people can learn about dog adoptions, but also pet adoptions in general. So we'll have a pop-up activation to where there will be adoptables on site that evening. We'll feature adoptable pets on the scoreboard throughout the game in kind of, you know, what I kind of term as puppy bowl fashion. And in fact, we are going to be having Miss Bree of Puppy Bowl fame out leading a pet parade before the game. And anyone who does want to bring their dog that night and join us on the field for a pep parade can do that as well, about a half hour before the game starts.
And that's on July 31st.
That's July 31st at Impact Field in Rosemont. And yeah, if all those details are available on the team website, at which is www.thechicagodogs.com. So just on our homepage, you'll see a banner slide across, and you can click there and get all the information for the night.
All right, Tim, thank you very much. Good luck with the season, which isn't going so great. I didn't want to bring that up. And I thank you for joining me on the radio really late at night. Thank you very much.
Yeah, no, you're welcome. It's getting better. We're getting more wins lately, but we'll have fun regardless. So I look forward to getting everybody out to Impact Field.
Okay, go Dogs. This is WGN Radio at 6 minutes after midnight. And you know what? I have noticed all over Chicago, there is construction. You go down the street over there, there's a crane. You look up in the air, and you go down over there, and it used to be a parking lot, and now there's some building going up over there. So is all this construction a good thing, and what the heck is going on? And is the building mostly centralized to the downtown area? Also, there's a new center for the Chicago Architecture Foundation. And I will tell you, those walking tours are incredible. And, you know, people tend to do this. They tend to, when Aunt Sally and Uncle Buddy, you get that reference? When they come into Chicago, we say, well, go to the Architecture River Cruise on Lake Michigan. That boat also goes on to, or take one of the walking tours, but people don't do it themselves. So, you know what? We shouldn't take our city, I don't think, completely for granted. We have in the studio Lance Friedman, Chicago Architecture Foundation River Cruise Tour Director. Are you a captain?
No, sir. Those captains know a lot more about driving a boat than I do.
Okay. I was thought maybe I had a salute or something. And Woody Wood, Chicago Architecture Foundation's Senior Director of Program Strategy. So, first of all, Woody, what is the Chicago Architecture Foundation? I bet there are people who don't know.
Well, the Chicago Architecture Foundation is a local nonprofit that's devoted to helping the public discover why design matters. That's a mission that we do through a number of different means, like public programs, architecture tours, exhibitions, youth education programs. We are the one-stop shop for all things architecture, and since that's sort of the number one sport here in Chicago, we are also probably the largest architecture center in the world, serving almost 700,000 people a year.
And you have a new center literally opening, I believe?
We do. We're moving up the street.
Everyone's moving. I think everyone's moving to Wacker Drive.
That's right.
We're here, so everyone moves to Wacker Drive. So you were. I interrupted you. I'm sorry.
That's okay. The center will be fully open at the end of August. We are moving to 111 East Wacker. That's right at the corner of the Michigan Avenue Bridge and Wacker Drive, just above where the river dock is to our architectural river cruise. The Chicago Architecture Foundation River Cruise First Lady.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a second.
That's right.
Yeah. So, San Francisco, New York, Seattle. I'm trying to think of some other cities in America that have incredible architecture. Maybe Philadelphia, you know, the old Boston, same thing.
Sure.
Is there a city that you can think of in this country that has as much variety as Chicago?
No. Not at all.
Hands down, right?
That's right.
And our skyline?
Is the best.
Not that you're biased or anything, but I mean, visitors come here. So this is true. It was a couple of weeks ago. I'm just walking down Michigan Avenue, as sometimes I do, and these people said, well, where is? And they were looking for, I think, Oak Street. You know, so I answered, and they said, this is the, they were from Poland, and they said, we didn't expect Chicago's architecture to be so interesting. You must get that every day.
We get that all the time. And in fact, just a couple of years ago when Choose Chicago was trying to figure out how to brand the city, wouldn't you know that architecture would always rise to the top, and it really is a big calling card. Ever since the Chicago Fire, it's just been a kind of a crucible of innovation, and some of the world's greatest architects have worked here. We still have a lot of their work on display, and their designs were exported around the world.
So when you walk around downtown or even near north and you look up in the sky, I've alluded to this a couple of times, you see cranes everywhere now. Is that a good sign?
Sure. I think generally that's a good sign. This is the highest level of activity we've seen in years. There's over 60 cranes up and around Chicago. We're the number one builder of residential towers right now in the United States. We have 10 mega developments of over $1 billion in construction. So the city is booming in that way, and that's certainly a good thing.
Now, I've got to ask you, the Chicago Tribune building, the beautiful, iconic Tribune building that just a month ago I was working out of, how can they do that? I mean, I mean that in a couple of different ways. First of all, how can they do that? But also, how can they do that? I mean, you've got a structure that is landmark. That's the word I was trying to think. It's a landmark building. They cannot change a whole lot of things. So how are they going to make, and for those who don't know, everyone was tossed out of the building because the Chicago Tribune building is going condo. So CNN, the Chicago Tribune, WGN Radio, and the other tenants in the building are gone. Bye-bye. And we're here in actually, I love this place. It's just absolutely beautiful. As far as radio studios go, all new equipment. I love it, love it, love it. But I worry about the iconic Chicago Tribune building. How are they going to do that?
Well, a couple things. You're living in a great era of cities and a rise of cities, and people want to live downtown, so the building is more valuable now as a residential property. The building is landmarked, and you won't see a lot of change from the outside looking in. But what you will see is that the large floor plates inside are perfectly great for residential because the views out of each side are pretty spectacular.
Yeah.
And it will be pretty lovingly restored. There's a recent precedent project, the Woolworth Building in New York City, which was once touted as the world's greatest office building and a very tall building that went up pretty quickly. Very lavish office building is now, you know, luxury residential.
Are we going to have too much of it? I have a friend that lives, oh gosh, began to say this, so I've got to finish. Some things you shouldn't say on the radio. So I have a friend that lives downtown, and I couldn't believe what she's selling her place for. I mean, at some point in time, are we going to have an overabundance of renters and condominiums downtown? I mean, how long are people going to continue? And it's not inexpensive. It's not only the building itself, of course. Even groceries cost more downtown. And I won't even mention the P word. That would be parking.
Well, yes, every real estate cycle happens. So eventually that will play out the way you're describing. And there's a new product on the market really since the Great Recession, which is what we call luxury rental. That's a whole new category that really wasn't here 10 years ago. And so those are a lot of units that are coming on, and we'll see how those fare over the long haul. But I think the long answer is that we are in a pretty healthy position in that most of these units that are being built are being occupied by locals. People are living in it. It's not a situation with dark money. And so at this point in time, I think the build-out is pretty healthy, and most of the developers are still cautiously optimistic that we're you know, in the thick of it.
Now, you'll know the name of it. I didn't write it down, and I thought, oh, I'll remember, but I didn't. The tallest building that is, it was going to happen, it wasn't going to happen, it was going to happen, and now, finally, it seems to be happening, blocking the views of, like, three other buildings, but nevertheless, it seems to be happening. What, you know what building I'm referring to?
Sure.
Right along the river?
Sure. I don't know. I would maybe challenge that. So you're thinking about when...
The Spire?
Calatrava was... Santiago Calatrava designed a 1,500... foot tall spire.
Yeah, that. Thank you. Yep. Yes,
which was really iconic against the skyline, just south of Navy Pier, on the west side of Lakeshore Drive, and that it was that went into default. And Related Midwest, a local developer, has picked it up. They recently unveiled a new design. It's a twin tower design, a much slimmer design, and there's the. Towers are canted to try to provide, to be as neighborly as possible, and to provide good views for the neighboring buildings. They're much smaller, slimmer buildings that I think actually will perform a lot better in the neighborhood, in the sense that a 1,500-foot tower at the base isn't very friendly. It's super terrific at the top, and it's great when out on the lake looking at it, but living next to that is a very big building. And what Related Midwest is trying to do is to pack a lot of people into a small place, but to be as neighborly as possible with some tall, skinny towers.
And how tall will those towers be?
There's two towers. One, the larger of the two, which is closer to the river, is roughly 1,000 feet high. And the smaller one is about, I want to say, 850. Maybe not, don't quote me at that, but about 850 and 1,000 feet high.
And to give us some idea, how many stories are we talking then, approximately?
Oh, that would
Sorry.
Be probably in the neighborhood
like 80,
of 70s.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
All right, so what are you, as you walk around the city, you see the construction going on, of all the construction going on anywhere, you point at something and say, we're going to remember this building, we'll be talking about this building once Ooh. It's up 10 years, 20 years, 30 years from now.
Gosh, that's a tough question. I can think of a few. When I think about developments, I think what we're seeing, and there's a project called the River Line, which is essentially just south of Sears Tower, Willis Tower, all the way down to Roosevelt. And that's kind of a planned community, but it's porous. And they're really inviting streets in, and they're allowing people to, if you don't live there, to still be able to get to the river's edge. And I think that will be a big turning point in sort of private development, but that's with public riverfront. That's a big one. And actually, going back to Related Midwest, they're just about to cap off a new tower just north of there, along Lakeshore Drive, called One Bennett Park, which will be probably the most expensive luxury rental, about $1,200 a square foot.
Why?
And that's the only building in the city by a famous architect, Robert A.M. Stern. I think it's a pretty terrific building in the sense that what it's really trying to do is provide some history and some soul to the Streeterville neighborhood. It's somewhat controversial because it's new and it's different. It doesn't look like its neighbors. But I think over time you'll realize that that's a pretty great anchor building in a neighborhood that needs some icons.
Right. The other one that I'd add to that is just a couple of doors down from here, Vista, which has been designed by Studio Gang, led by Genie Gang, you know, one of the world's great architects today. And it's a three towers next to each other. The tallest of them will become the second tallest building in Chicago when it's completed. And it's got a lovely, curvy shape to it. And people already love the Aqua building that she designed and finished in 2009, which is also just about a half a block from here. So we're all very excited to see how that takes shape.
And if you wanted to ask what the public thinks, a new building about 2 years old now by Getch Partners, 150 North Riverside, which is on the west side of the river, just south of the river confluence, is a very skinny, tall building that threads through some Metro and Amtrak rail lines, and is a real winsome office tower.
All right, so you look out the window. Well, maybe not now because it's kind of dark outside, but you see maybe our greatest assets right here in one view, Lake Michigan and the Chicago River. And there is a great thing that the Chicago Architecture Foundation has been doing for several years now. We'll talk about that when we come back on WGN. It is 12:18. WGN Radio, it is 12:22. Tempted to play DJ when I do that, right? And just stop at the post. And it's been a few years. Was that Tom Jones? It sounded like Tom Jones. I'm not sure who it was. Let's see if I... Go ahead.
This song?
Yeah. No, oh, Proud...
It's Creedence. CCR.
Yeah, CCR. Yeah. Rolling on a river. I should have known that. Like 1971, right? Tom shaking his head yes, as if he knows. He wasn't even born in 1971, probably. It is 12:23 on WGN. My name is Steve Dale. I am here until 1 o'clock, then Nick DiGilio rolls right in. We are talking about the Chicago Architecture Foundation and those cruises that go out onto the Chicago River and Lake Michigan. We're talking from the Chicago Architecture Foundation with Woody Wood. Woody Wood. I won't even say anything about that. And also Lance Friedman. Lance Friedman is the River Cruise Tour Director. Mr. Wood is the Senior Director of Program Strategy with the Chicago Architecture Foundation. So here's what I tell people. I say you can take, because everyone, and there are more cruise lines than ever that go out onto the lake and down the river, and they all say, we have an architecture cruise. They all do it. And the other captains of those boats, very nice people, I'm sure, say, and this is what it sounds like, their narration. There's a tall building, and there's a taller one, and that one isn't quite as tall. There is only one Chicago Architecture Foundation cruise. So first of all, tell us, and I say that because that is the only one that your docents participate on, I believe.
That's absolutely true.
Yeah, and there is a difference. There's an enormous difference between those cruises by your trained docents and the captains that are doing their best, but they're also captaining a boat, and they're not expert on Chicago architecture. They don't keep up with things, and some of what I've heard on some of those other tours, I think is kind of made up about certain celebrities that lived in certain buildings that I don't believe were ever in Chicago in their lives. So, instead, this is the real deal.
Well, it's gratifying to hear you say that. We hear that from a lot of our guests, too. And I think it's, you know, to me, the biggest positive thing about the Chicago Architecture Foundation River Cruise aboard Chicago First Lady Cruises is, you know, people like me, we're doing it because we love architecture. We're all volunteers, and we do it because we love architecture, and also, the Chicago Architecture Foundation really puts us through a pretty rigorous training. I mean, we spend many weeks, many hours learning about the things to talk about on the river. There's a very rigorous certification process by veteran docents that we have to go through before we can stand up and talk in front of the public. And then every year in April, before the season kicks off, we make everybody get out, and it's always freezing cold when we go out, and everybody's just chilled to the bone. We say, all right, you got to learn about the new buildings, what's come up since last year, and what are the new things that you want to talk about in the coming year. And every docent, like you said, develops their own tour. They talk about the things that are most important to them and that they're most excited about.
All right, so this is a crazy, unfair question, but, you know, I'll ask it anyway. So what is the craziest question, I'm sure you've gotten many, that you've been asked, or just one of them?
Well,
I could tell you some of them that I've gotten, but yours are better, I'm sure.
Well, it's sort of the craziest question, but a lot of times it's just, how is that building standing up? And and Woody mentioned, you know, the latest building that's right there at the River Junction. It's 150 North Riverside, and it's got this skinny little footprint. The designers, Getch Partners, who are here in Chicago, they said in one of Woody's programs a year ago, the site designed the building. They had this little skinny place to have the footprint, goes up four stories, then it fans out to three times that width, goes up 50 stories, and it's just staggering. It looks like a tuning fork.
Which building is that?
It's called 150 North Riverside, and it's right at the junction of the river at the southwest part of it. And when I take people out on my cruise and we're going through the junction and they see the shape of it, and it's like a ballerina standing on point, and then it's going up 50 stories, they're just stunned by how it stands up. And it does that with, you know, amazing structural engineering. And a little secret that we share, that in order to keep the building from swaying too much when it's really windy, they have there's a fancy name for it, but they basically have a big swimming pool filled with water on the top floor, so that as the wind blows the building one way, the water sloshes back the other way.
Come on.
And it makes the building move less overall in the wind.
Are you making that up?
No, this is absolutely true. The structural engineers are the magicians who make possible the designs that the architects develop.
So along the river, and when you go out onto the lake, what is the building that you've talked about 5,000 times and you are still most astonished by?
Well, that is definitely one of them.
Sure.
And, you know, it's sort of a classic that, you know, the Willis Tower... Excuse me, originally the Sears Tower, there was just so much innovation in being able to build that building that tall back in the mid-70s that nobody had thought of doing before. So we talk about how that was made possible. And Aqua is always a pleaser just because of its sinuous balconies and sort of the random shape of each of those balconies. People just, and it looks like a waterfall going down the side because the windows are different colors.
Yeah, it sort of does. And the coolest thing about Aqua, which we've mentioned a couple times now, is the architect's name is?
Jeannie Gang.
And Jeannie Gang is a woman.
She is, and yes.
Yeah, well, that's unusual, I believe.
Well, it definitely is. She is one of the leading architects in the world today. She happens to be a woman. She's practicing here in Chicago, and she's just always has a unique inspiration for her different buildings. Aqua, she will tell you, was inspired by geologic formations on the upper Great Lakes that she remembered, with sort of horizontal rocks and water cascading over them. And each of her buildings is unique and just a delight to look at.
Well, I truly wish we had more time, but we're out of it. So how do people learn more about the Chicago Architecture Foundation, including those walking tours that we didn't even get to talk about, and your new center? So again, your new center is open when and where?
We open at the end of August. It opens to the public August 31st. It's at 111 East Wacker, right at the corner of the Michigan Avenue Bridge and Wacker Drive. You can learn everything about the Chicago Architecture Foundation at www.architecture.org.
And the cruises?
Same place. All the information on the cruises is there. They're going out every 30 minutes every day through the rest of the summer. And everybody's got to do what you do, Steve, which is make sure you take that cruise once this year.
I totally agree. That's cruisechicago.com, too, I think, right? I think so. Take my word for it. Guys, thank you so much. I love the work you do at the Chicago Architecture Foundation. So thank you both for coming in.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
A city full of other drivers who don't care about your morning rush hour travel times. Let me help. I'm Mary Vandeveld in WGN Traffic Central. Weekday mornings on the Steve Cochran Show on 720 WGN.
It is 1230 on WGN. The Margarita Festival's coming to town. Woo! That we will talk about next. Yeah, it's okay. So we were trying to find the guest who was going to talk about the Chicago Margarita Festival, something that I know you're intimately familiar with, Roger.
Why, yes, I am.
Well, yeah, because I was filling in, what was it, 2 or 3 months ago, yeah, on a different shift. It was very early in the morning, and Alex brought in some margaritas. Mm-hmm. So perhaps he had too many of those. I'm not sure. We can't track him down, but we will try to do that. I have a question for you.
Okay, I hope I have the right answer for you.
Well, can I get personal?
Well, you ask the question, we'll take it from there.
Have you ever been to a cat convention?
A cat convention? Well, I've been at a gathering of cats, but that's only because it was a shelter.
No,
I have not been to a cat convention.
So you're probably wondering, well, what happens at a cat convention?
Do the cats walk around with ID badges and go to different seminars? Or, I don't know.
Well, the people learn about cats can go to different seminars. So it's this Saturday and Sunday at the Rosemont Convention Center. Mm-hmm. This is legit. It's called the Meow Meetup. And I will tell you, thousands of people really go to this sort of thing to see. So let me ask you a question. You'll understand why.
Okay.
What is the most popular thing on the internet?
Oh,
the subject matter.
Yeah, pictures of cats, cute little kitty cats.
Well, actually, that's the second most popular thing, but I won't talk about the most popular thing. So, yes,
okay,
kitty cats are the second most popular, according to several different sources, the track, you know, where people go online. That is the most second popular thing that people go to are images of and videos, especially videos, cat videos. They're huge. These cats have become celebrities on not only Facebook, but also especially Instagram. Cats like Little Bub. Have you heard of Little Bub?
No, I've never heard of Little Bub.
Little Bub. I think you have to say it like that. I'm not sure. Little Bub. So Little Bub is going to be at the Meow Meetup. And lots of other celebrity cats are going to be there, too, like Cole and Marmalade. Very famous. If you're a cat person, you know who these folks are. Or these cats. They will be there as well. But in addition to that, there's cat yoga.
Ooh.
So you're doing yoga, uh-huh, and you're in a room where there are cats walking around, and you're doing all these different poses. What is not allowed, I believe, the downward dog. That would be...
Oh, no. Are you kidding? It's a cat convention.
Of course.
Crazy or what?
That's right. You can't do that. And in addition, there will be cat bingo. I'm not quite sure myself what that's all about.
So it's a big, huge bingo card in the middle of the room, and the cats walk around, and wherever they sit, that's what it is.
Have you seen the Animal Planet shows where dogs do agility? It's like an obstacle course for dogs?
Yeah, I've seen those. Yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm. They have cat agility.
Ooh.
But in addition to all of that and more, there will be educational seminars, like you said. You're actually right about that. So this is being partnered by there's this publication that's well known. It's the journalistic place to be. It's called the New York Times,
mm-hmm,
but maybe not in the cat world. It's called the Catnip Times.
Oh.
And there is such a thing. Do you write for them, by the way?
Well, no, I don't. I haven't gotten my paws into that publication yet.
You should. So they are co-sponsoring this with the American Veterinary Medical Association, right? They are as legitimate can be, and they have asked different speakers to offer educational programs. I'm offering a couple of those. So on Saturday at 10 a.m., I'll be doing the keynote address. I'll be talking about why cats are the Rodney Dangerfield of pets. You have to come to hear what that's all about. I'll be also talking about how to encourage cats to scratch in all the right places. And I'll be doing something called, and maybe you should be there with me to do this with me, Roger.
Oh, I'd love to.
Love letters to cats.
Oh, man. I could sit there with a little a little Yanni in the background. I could be reading those love letters. Maybe a little Barry White, maybe.
Exactly.
Yes, I could. Oh, man. We've got to do this. Lights, bring the lights down low in the room.
That do we have cool. any, Tom? We should get some Barry White music Barry White. Here. Hey, Tom. Tom's on the telephone. Oh. But when he get, hey, Tom, some Barry White music. You know, if you could find some Barry White music, that would be good. And we'll try this out, Roger, and we'll okay. see. This will be kind of the rehearsal for what I'll do. On Sunday, and she will be on my show early Sunday morning at 6:30, Becky Robinson from Alley Cat Allies. Mm-hmm. That's an organization that supports trap, neuter, return, and release of community cats, mm-hmm. which is a really good thing. It keeps the shelter numbers down, and it's the most humane thing that can mm-hmm. be done for cats. So that is all this Saturday and Sunday. It's called the Meow Meetup. It's at the Rosemont Convention Center, and if you go to my blog, you'll hear about it. All right.
I love you. You have four paws. You purr. You sit on my head at 3 a.m. I love that, too. You bring everything in your life and mice back to the house for me. Sometimes birds.
How's that?
That's awesome. That is so cool.
I'm not so sure of that. So I'm not sure if that's what it will be like when I read love letters to cats. But it will be the event, really will be this Saturday and Sunday. And you can check it out for further details on my blog, and that is stevedale.tv. So I've got good news for you.
Mm.
You're going to be so excited.
We got margaritas in the house.
We found, well, on the phone.
Oh.
So I don't know why he's on the phone and not in the house. We will find out, and we will talk about the Chicago Margarita Festival next, right here on WGN. So, Mr. Badish,
yeah.
if you don't mind,
yeah.
sit, stay. We'll be right back. There it is. It's coming to Chicago. It's the most important thing ever of all the guests that I've ever interviewed in my life. This could be the most important person, and I will even forgive him for whatever mix-up happened. But we've got him on the phone. We found him. Alex Blackshire, event coordinator of Chicago Margarita. I said it! Margarita Festival!
How are you? How are you, Roger? My apologies.
Not a problem. I'm reimagining the last one.
I have more, too.
Oh no.
So, are you in the car?
Yes, I was driving there. I mixed up. I thought it was 1 o'clock. The scheduling mixed up with Folsom 12:30.
Well, yeah. Maybe Nick DiGilio will want to have you at 1 o'clock. I don't know. But we're off the air at 1 o'clock. But we're on the air now to talk about this. The Chicago Margarita Festival. What is it?
It is a bringing together of culture for five different tastings of mango margarita, strawberry margarita, peach margarita, a classic margarita, and we also have one secret that we're holding back.
Ooh.
But it's July 28th and 29th. There are three tasting sessions. It's at Navy Pier. The time began, the dates are July 28th and 29th, and we're bringing together close to 1,000 or so of our friends to taste margaritas.
Now, it's just not a, like, you go to a beer tasting, and you, I love those. You have a selection of 5 or 6 or 7 beers, maybe, and you have a little sip of each. This isn't like that, is it?
No, it's sort of. I mean, Navy Pier is very persnickety on how they like things done, but what we're going to do is the guests are able to buy full size, you know, once they're there. That's no problem. So it's somewhat of a tasting because that's how we're pairing it so that people can try more and not have to imbibe so much, but they'll also be able to have full drinks.
All right. Now, are you prepared to give us in a couple of minutes the ultimate margarita recipe?
Well, I am prepared to give you my ultimate margarita.
It's good enough for me. You are a professor of tequila. So that's a very, I'm sure it'll be just wonderful. So you go to the event, it's at Navy Pier, you go to the event, and what you're recommending, because I know it's all over your website, and I think it's a brilliant idea, and you have a partnership with, is it Uber?
That's correct. We do with Uber and Lyft. It's basically We have codes where first-time users can have $15 off their ride to be able to get to and fro from the event. We're still in talks to try to work and see if we can have guests who have currently used Uber as well to provide them with free codes.
Yeah, because we don't necessarily want people driving to the event and back if they're going to indulge in all the margaritas we're talking about. Now, I hope there's some food involved as well. Otherwise, this might be darn dangerous.
Yes. Yes, there is food. Last year, we chose a different approach. We're going to be a bit different this year. From when we talked last time, we did things such as Asian crostini. We did stuffed cheese mushrooms last year. But the portions we noticed with the actual margaritas, people seem to want it more. So what we're going to do is we're going to take more of a classic approach. There'll still be foods that deal with what pairs well with margaritas, such as guacamole, chips, chicken, things of that nature. But we're also going to add some American food, South foods with it as well.
All right. Now, when we had you in the studio, it was a very dramatic, and it was nice to meet you in person, Alex. But I feel badly about what happened. What we did to our revered, esteemed broadcasting newscaster, who Roger Badish has never been the same, I don't believe. So I don't know that Roger has previously had tequila. It's interesting what has happened. Oh, I don't know, in the past 5 years or so with tequila, it really has become... So the old impression was, if you want to get drunk, want to get a headache, have tequila. Well, now it's become, people are beginning to better understand, I think, what tequila really is. I mean, the finer tequilas aren't to take shots for, they're to sip. And what's more, you've got these flavored tequilas now, and I believe the goal is to reach particularly women.
Yeah. That's what we've noticed with our Margarita Festival, as, of course, our numbers are very much skewed in front of females, 60% female, maybe 40% male.
Really?
So, yes, and it's the flavors that they're actually very interested in. As you mentioned, traditionally, you had, of course, the tasting, which dealt with the aging of the process inside of the barrel, and, you know, those are your classic blue agave tequilas. But you also see the mixtos. The mixtos contain more sugar. I don't know if that's a good or bad thing, but we are seeing some of the mixtos becoming very popular, opposed to the traditional tequila that ages with the oak taste that people normally sip off.
So there's, help me here, there's the very aged tequila is... I know this. Okay, so the slightly aged is Reposado. The very aged is called Añejo. But it's typically the Blanco tequila that gets us in trouble. That's the white tequila. Have I got that right?
You do. Well, the old saying is that blue agave weren't supposed to give you a headache because they were 100% pure tequila. And it was supposed to be more of the mixtos because they have all of the sugars, glycerin, and things and other mixtures that don't pair well. I'd like to see someone test that, though. But yes, it's the blue agaves are normally the ones that aren't supposed to provide any type of headache.
So that's an interesting thing, the testing. So are you looking for maybe a certain newsman to go out in advance to test to make sure that you've got the right combination of tequilas there?
We will try a mixto on him. That would be correct. And then we'll apply him with a blue agave, probably a Reposado.
Notice. I don't care what you call it, just call me.
All right, so people are making margaritas more than ever before, and it's interesting because Cinco de Mayo, the 5th of May, is, I think, now a bigger holiday by far in America, than it is in Mexico. What prompted the Chicago Margarita Festival? Where did the idea come from?
As we mentioned when we talked before, I was traveling in Tampa Bay and noticed that they had an exceptional margarita festival. And as I mentioned before, they very well put together. So we looked around, as I mentioned, our city of Chicago. We didn't see the same thing here. And so we decided, let's reproduce that. So we started off outdoors. We've had some growing pains, and we've learned a few things along the way, and we landed at Navy Pier. So our start and impetus is because we saw something so wonderful in Tampa Bay, Florida, and we decided Chicago must have the same thing, if not even better.
Mm-hmm. And what will make it better?
Well, we are working on that. What I think the key to that is the proper mixing of your margaritas. And in fact, okay. Yeah, we reached out to, I believe, one of the greatest mixers, Blue Agave Tequila Bar and Restaurant here in Chicago. We're trying to get them to come in and make the margaritas for us this year. I have a flavor that I can do, but I know when someone's better than me.
So who's going to be? That's a good question, actually. You bring up a good point. So yeah. I've been to establishments where the mixologist actually makes all the difference in the world, who's creating that margarita.
It really does, because it is the, for example, the person who's had the most experience of it, they can tell whether that tequila is properly mixed with, as we mentioned, our recipe we gave, 3-2-1. They try the different portions. They know when to add a bit more lime, depending on whether they're dealing with the Blanco, or Reposado, or Añejo. All of that comes from experience that you can't cheat. So, yeah, that is, it is the mixologist.
All right. Now, are you ready to give us the recipe?
Yes. I will give you what we plied Roger with.
All right.
Of course, because I was too interested in the brew to actually take down notes at the time. So
all right.
I got pencil and paper ready, and I'm ready for it.
Go for it, Alex.
Good thing. It's our margarita that we normally do, of course, is very simple. I call it the 3-2-1. And as we mentioned, it's 3 parts and 3 ounces of tequila, no matter what your portions are. 3 parts tequila, 2 parts Cointreau, and 1 part fresh lime. Must be fresh, nothing from the green squeezy that you can buy in the store. And from that, once you have that perfect 3-2-1 combination, you should have, which I should have mentioned first, had a chilled glass that has ice in it, and then which has been salted properly on the rim. You then shake that 3-2-1 combination in a shaker over ice, and once that shaker is frozen on the outside and you can make a smiley face like we did last time, then that margarita should be perfect. So again, our perfect margarita is 3-2-1. 3 parts tequila, preferably a reposado, 100% blue agave, not the mixto, Cointreau, which is a French liqueur made from the peels of oranges, which is a very great blend. And then we also do, again, fresh lime.
All right. By the way, this will all be
down.
Yeah, and if you missed it and you didn't get it all down, you have a couple choices. One is you can call Roger up and he'll repeat it for you. Or when the show is podcast, you could check it out and take notes there, WGN.com, WGNradio.com. Now, when is, again, let's go through it. When is the Margarita Festival, Chicago Margarita Festival? Where is it at? And also, how can people get tickets?
Wonderful. Again, it's the Chicago Margarita Festival. It will be held at Navy Pier on July 28th and 29th. That's Saturday and Sunday. The first session starts at 11 a.m. and runs until 6 p.m. The second session runs from 7 p.m. until 12 a.m., where you can also see a fireworks show over Navy Pier.
That's great. And
the final session runs on Sunday. That will be from 12 to 7 p.m. And again, we do 5 flavors of margaritas. We also this year decided with live music. There will be live calypso bands, as well as we'll do an island sound of live recording artists.
Okay.
So that is the gist of it. Navy Pier, our website is www.chicagomargaritafestival.com for more information.
Well, I'm thinking you could see fireworks on Sunday, too. Because if you have enough of those margaritas, you're going to see fireworks.
I believe you will, and it's specifically the classic margarita.
Of course. All right, Alex, thank you very much for joining us. I'm sorry about whatever the mix-up was or is. One more time, what is that website?
Sure. That website is Chicago Margarita Festival, www.chicagomargaritafestival.com.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, and I apologize for the mix-up.
No problem. Are you ready, Roger?
Yes, I am.
All right. I think I am, too. In fact, you want to rehearse tonight?
Well, all right. I'll have to rearrange my schedule. Sure.
Okay.
Just wondering how big of a glass I should bring.
I think they give you glasses.
I think I need may need a bigger glass, though. I don't think they got a... Because my 3-2-1 involves buckets.
Not the way you drink, my friend. I don't think that's the truth.